Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. Who do you like better, the Rolling Stones or the Beatles? The question is interesting to music fans even today, but for the baby boom generation, the answer to it served as a kind of shibboleth, so that preferring one band over the other placed you in a musical tribe and implied something about your tastes, your ideals, and your view of the world. But as my guest today will tell us, the rivalry began as much as a product of marketing as of genuine antagonism between the two bands. John McMillan is assistant professor of history at Georgia State University. His new book is called Beatles versus Stones, and he joins us today from the studios of NPR in New York City. John, welcome to Think.
Thank you so much for having me. It's a pleasure to be here.
So your last book looked at the underground press in the 1960s. How did that project lead you to examine this rivalry?
Well, it led fairly directly. You know, in the late 60s, say around the summer of 1968, there is a tremendous ideological debate among rock fans about which group, the Beatles or the Stones, had the correct political analysis. And this debate was carried on in these radical and countercultural underground newspapers that are kind of far-flung and difficult to find if you're not a historian and a researcher. But the Beatles were regarded by a lot of people as championing the counterculture and the aesthetic radicalism of love and peace and nonviolence and so on. Whereas the Stones in 1968 were thought to align themselves with the more militant, hard-charging politics of confrontation that you got from the new left. So there's a bit of a divide among young people about which was the correct political approach in that contentious era. And people were looking to the Beatles and the Stones for political guidance. And so that was an essay I wrote that emerged from my first book, and then that led to the book that we're discussing now.
Were they actively political beyond what people could glean from the lyrics in their songs?
Well, not so much. You know, the Beatles were certainly culturally hugely and profoundly influential to a lot of young people. But then, you know, under the influence of their manager, Brian Epstein, they never really got involved in the big political causes of their day. They never tried to ban atomic weapons or support the civil rights movement. They spoke out very tepidly against the Vietnam War, but they certainly were not activists. They weren't actively trying to end the war. And with regard to the Stones, I think their radicalism was a bit faddish. They never seemed to really seriously study or consider the big political issues of the day, but they could certainly project themselves as groups that were radical or whatnot. But behind the scenes, that neither group was terribly politically active.
What sorts of lives had each band led before they found their way to organize together and to play together and to ultimately get record deals?
Well, there were differences among the members within each band.
Yeah.
But speaking very generally, you know, the Beatles grew up in Liverpool, which was a pretty depressed, economically depressed city in northern England. And they came from mostly working class backgrounds. And England, of course, was a society that was very class segmented, and there wasn't as much social mobility as we see today. And so, you know, for the most part, the Beatles were expecting careers in low wage and, you know, low prestige vocations if they had not become famous as musicians and rock stars. There's an interesting anecdote in the book. John Lennon was once asked by the headmaster of his school to write down some occupations that he thought he might be suitable for, and John Lennon wrote salmon fisherman. and in fact, he was the only one of the four Beatles who grew up in a household that had running water, which is surprising, although Liverpool, of course, was bombed during World War II, and so it's not quite as surprising as it may seem, but I was surprised to learn that. By contrast, the Rolling Stones grew up in London and the London suburbs. And, you know, Mick Jagger was upper middle class, and he went to the London School of Economics, which is a very prestigious school. And this is at a time when only about 2% of British kids went on to university study. And Brian Jones, who founded the Rolling Stones, did not go on to university, but he could have. He tested very well at his grammar school. And so the, their career prospects were much brighter than the Beatles when they were all growing up.
And the Beatles had actually hit it big before the Stones, but I thought it was interesting that early on, even they didn't necessarily believe that they were sort of in this for a very long time, that it would last for them.
Well, that's right. There was no precedent for a band to sort of mature and evolve and grow old the way the Beatles and the Stones did. So, yeah, they very much believed that they were this incredible fad. And when Beatlemania was going strong, they were trying to, they were working as hard as possible because they wanted to capitalize on this sensation. And then they figured it pretty soon all the hoopla would die down and they'd have to move on. And so they outmaneuvered a lot of people, of course, by maturing and growing older and writing more autobiographically and so on. But that was a new move that the Beatles did.
Tell us about their first meeting.
Between the Beatles and the Stones.
Yeah.
The Beatles at that point, this was in 1963, they were just becoming quite popular in England, although Beatlemania had not quite hit, but and certainly they were not a worldwide attraction. But they were big enough that the Beatles moved from Liverpool to London, and they were kind of new to the London scene, and they got word about the Rolling Stones, and they decided to see the Stones at a tiny club called the Crawdaddy Club, which was where the Stones had a residency. And the Stones, by that point, had developed a very good cult following among some sort of bohemians and art students and young people in London, but they didn't even have a record contract at the time. But the two groups quickly, they got along. I think the Beatles admired what the Stones were doing. The Stones were flattered that the Beatles would come to their show and say kind things. And so they stayed up all night till 4 in the morning the first night they met, spinning records and talking about their mutual interests and so on. And so they developed a bit of a rapport from the very first time they met.
And not too long after that, the Beatles actually helped the Stones out with a song to record. How did that happen?
The Stones, like a lot of other groups in that era, were mostly recording cover songs. They did not fast. They didn't think of themselves as songwriters. But John Lennon and Paul McCartney, of course, had a different attitude. They were writing songs they had a lot of songs. And the Stones were having a tough time at one of their recording sessions trying to come up with a single. And they just by happenstance, the Rolling Stones manager met John Lennon and Paul McCartney walking down the street. And it's remarkable to think what would have happened if that, you know, coincidence had not occurred. But anyhow, John and Paul went to the recording studio and they finished up a sort of Bo Diddley-ish number that they were working on called I Wanna Be Your Man. And that was a song that they had intended for Ringo to sing, but they told the Stones they could have it as well. And they finished the song right before the Stones' very eyes in just a matter of minutes. And the Stones were flabbergasted that the Beatles could write this song with such facility. And they recorded it, and it was a big hit for the Stones.
Well, let's listen to what the Stones did with it, and then we will sort of fade into how the Beatles treated the same song. That was first the Rolling Stones and then the Beatles singing I Wanna Be Your Man, a Lennon and McCartney tune. We're speaking this hour with John McMillan, assistant professor of history at Georgia State University and author of the book Beatles versus Stones. John, I absolutely love hearing those two performances next to one another because it's such a great example of the differences sort of stylistically between these two bands.
Yeah, it really does show that, doesn't it? You know, the Beatles' version is a little cleaner and perhaps a bit more polished, and the Stones dirtied the song up a little bit. And the Stones, of course, had that blues influence, and Brian Jones' guitar work on that song is pretty interesting to me. I think the Stones' version is a bit superior to the Beatles, actually.
Yeah, it sounds better. Song. So the sort of cleaning up of the image of the Beatles happened a lot under the management of Brian Epstein. Can you talk about that relationship and the kinds of changes that he thought would make them stars?
Sure. You know, when the Beatles were first getting going, they were young, scruffy, bohemian types. You know, they had the leather jackets. They really favored, you know, all types of music, but particularly American rock and roll, which they liked to play kind of loud and fast. And you know, they were very informal when they performed. They would joke and banter with the audience, and sometimes they would eat and drink and smoke on stage in the middle of their shows. And so Brian Epstein, of course, polished up their image, and he gradually got them to get into the suits and to bow and conform and be polite and so on. And that was something that he thought was important for marketing purposes. And so that was and it was a big contribution to the group, of course.
And it definitely worked for them, but it also meant that they had a lot of young fans early on.
Yeah, a lot of people, I think, misunderstand just how young the Beatles fan base was when they were first getting going. Now, in England, it's true that they were popular with all levels of society. Adults liked them. They got favorable coverage in newspapers, and they played before the British royal family, and they won awards from politicians. But all that notwithstanding, the Beatles' core audience was just very young girls, 12, 13, and 14 years old, at least when they were first starting in England.
So it's funny because it sounds like, you know, Justin Bieber or One Direction or something today.
People say that a lot, although Beatlemania was on a scale that was so much larger and more important than the accolades that Justin Bieber gets. It was a different type of phenomenon.
So the Stones, meanwhile, early on, were still trying to get a record deal after the Beatles had sort of broken in England in particular. How did they find their way to the public image that would eventually be set under the direction of Andrew Oldham?
Well, you know, the Rolling Stones rose to fame comparatively quickly. It was about a year to the day from the time that Keith Richards and Mick Jagger and Brian Jones played together until they became Decca recording artists and were on national television. And initially, their manager, Andrew Luke Oldham, thought that he would portray the Stones as maybe successors to the Beatles. The thinking was that the Beatles' popularity couldn't last for very long and someone was going to have to take their spot. And so initially, he put the Stones in matching outfits as well. And a lot of people don't know this, but there are some rare photos. One of them appears in my book of the Stones in matching suits and ties and vests, you know, smiling and grinning and with very short hair, looking very dainty, kind of like these Liverpool groups that were popular at the time. But that did not last long. You know, before too much longer, the Stones got out of their matching outfits and dressed the way they wanted. And they were encouraged by their manager to style themselves a bit like the anti-Beatles. If the Beatles were going to be, you know, very genial and friendly and so on, the Stones would be a little bit louche and inconsiderate. And they began to win affection from more disaffected, you know, rebellious teenagers.
We're speaking this hour with John McMillan, assistant professor of history at Georgia State University and author of the new book, Beatles versus Stones. If you want to be part of the conversation, you can call in to 1-800-933-5372, send email to think@kera.org, or send me a tweet at Chris Boyd Think.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education. Classes are available in everything from fine arts to financial planning, and gift certificates are available at 214-768-CAPE or smu.edu/think.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with John McMillan, assistant professor of history at Georgia State University and author of the new book, Beatles versus Stones. You can be part of the conversation at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. So, John, to the extent that a rivalry existed, at least as one could read in fan magazines, what did that look like and sound like?
Well, the Beatles and the Stones are interesting because they have such a great deal in common in the sense that they were roughly the same age. They came out of England at the same time. They both loved African-American music. But they had there were differences as well that make the comparison between the two groups irresistible. And of course, the Beatles were a bit more polished in their recordings, and they were influenced by Motown particularly, and a lot of the girl groups from that era, like the Shirelles or later on the Ronettes and the Shangri-Las, were, you know, very influential to what the Beatles were doing. And the Stones had a more sort of rugged and perhaps unpolished sound when they recorded, and they were interested in the blues, you know, Jimmy Reed and Muddy Waters and the Mississippi and Chicago blues artists are the people who most inspired the Stones.
Although the Stones were doing less sort of pure blues after they signed with Decca, weren't they?
Well, they began to move away from some of their blues purism when they were first getting going. You know, the blues was kind of a niche genre in England, and it was only popular with, I guess, what we would consider today, nowadays, you know, hipsters. It was really hard music to find, and it was obscure. And they saw themselves as kind of evangelists for this music, and they really wanted to popularize it in the clubs. But once they got their recording contract, I think they tasted a bit of success and wanted some more of it, and so they toned some of that blues purism down in an attempt to create a slightly more commercially appealing sound.
So Andrew Luke Oldham had worked briefly for Brian Epstein. Is that right?
That's right. He did some publicity work for Brian Epstein, a little bit of work for the Beatles, but mostly for some other Liverpool artists that Brian Epstein managed.
How would you characterize the differences in their approaches to band management?
Epstein and Oldham?
Mm-hmm.
Well, Epstein, as we mentioned, was the person who got the Beatles to, you know, get in the suits and bow and conform and be polite. And Andrew Luke Oldham was quite a bit younger. He was a brash guy. He had a very close personal rapport with the Stones, particularly Mick Jagger. And, you know, he had this sort of daring, witty, impish style where he wanted the Stones to really make a sensation as sort of the anti-Beatles. And he had this motto that said that, you know, whenever things go badly for the Stones, that's actually good news. And he encouraged the Stones to even be a bit more, you know, obnoxious in their personal behavior than they probably actually wanted to be in order to generate, you know, tabloid controversy. And so, you know, since then, it's become a pretty well-known scam. But he was a marketing genius, I would suggest.
It's funny to think about somebody like Mick Jagger, who, you know, had a degree from the London School of Economics, sort of faking this Cockney accent on occasion when he was being interviewed.
He didn't quite have a degree because he dropped out, but you're absolutely right. He could speak in a very proper, educated accent if he wanted to, but he would go back and forth depending on his mood and who he was talking to and what kind of impression he wanted to convey.
And how did the Beatles, early on when they were still sort of constricted by this squeaky clean image, feel looking at the Stones, who were allowed to go around and do whatever they wanted and be as bad as they wanted?
Well, you know, the Beatles were incredibly ambitious. So I think that they were happy to, you know, get into these suits and sort of put across a mollifying image in order to have the commercial success that they craved. But having said that, you know, John Lennon particularly had the toughest time, you know, adhering to this amiable pop top image when in fact that wasn't the type of guy he really was, you know. And so I think he felt to some degree that the Stones had maybe hijacked the Beatles' original image, and John, you know, grumbled a bit about the fact that he so often had to contain his personality for the sake of public relations. And especially later on in the 60s, as he would have more and more difficulty with that.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. You can also send email to think@kera.org. Okay, so John, tell us about the people who were responsible for generating publicity about bands in the early 60s, because there was entertainment media, but it looked a little bit different than the sort that we have today.
Well, I'm not sure I exactly understand the question.
Well, there were... I'm sorry, continue.
Well, I was just going to say that in England they had a different media environment than we have in the U.S., and one thing they had were a lot of weekly music newspapers, and those papers were always teeming with headlines about, you know, who was up one week and who was down the next and who beat who in the regular readers' poll and so on. And so that could help maybe fuel the impression of rivalry and competition between all the groups. And so that played into the Beatles-Stones rivalry to some degree. Although, in fact, the Beatles outsold the Stones by quite a wide margin. And then also the British loved their tacky tabloid newspapers. And so, you know, they would find sensationalistic stories about the groups that would help them sell, you know, papers at the newsstand.
What do you do when this, as a historian, when your source material is, you know, at least somewhat drawn from, you know, tabloid reporting, and how do you verify the things that were reported then?
Well, you know, it's interesting. I'm glad you asked. I have a PhD in history, and so I've tried to be as scrupulous as I could about getting the story right. And unfortunately, there have been so many books about the Beatles and the Stones, and many of them are very good, but a lot of them are actually quite poor with regards to, you know, accuracy, for instance. And so I just use the training that I have as a historian to try to find verification for the information that goes in the book. And then also I spent quite a bit of money, of my own money, on eBay, getting old fan magazines and teen magazines and underground newspapers, because some of these sources have not really been explored by scholars. And so I was able to bring some new primary source material to light. And that's one of the things I guess I feel a bit proud of with regard to the book.
Yeah, because I guess you couldn't go to libraries. They didn't have copies of these teen fan newspapers.
Not in the United States. In England, they do have a complete run of the Beatles and Stones fan magazines. But I did a cost analysis, and it would have I could buy them off eBay almost for as much as it would cost to fly to England for a couple of weeks. And so I thought that was the wiser thing to do.
So what did it take for each band to move across the Atlantic and have a major presence here in the U.S.?
Well, the Beatles had a great deal of advance hype and publicity. You know, there was a huge marketing campaign, and, you know, people are always trying to understand or fathom, you know, what caused Beatlemania in the U.S. because it was such a strange sensation, and I don't know if we'll ever have a full answer. But there was a lot of marketing that went into it. And the Stones didn't get that kind of marketing. When they came to the United States, they came on the heels of the Beatles and also the Dave Clark Five and the Herman's Hermits and some other British invasion bands. But the Stones were just on a tighter budget, and they were also a little more unusual compared to the you know, Liverpool groups and to the Dave Clark Five. And so they just had a bit of a tougher time. They had to really work hard to win over their audiences, and they later agreed that that made them a better band.
How much did the Beatles have to do, albeit accidentally, with the ability of the Stones to acquire a Decca contract in the UK?
Well, the Beatles, there were only two main record labels in England at the time. It was EMI and Decca. And so the Beatles got signed by EMI, and then that was a huge boon to EMI because the Beatles were selling so many records, but also all the other bands wanted to be with EMI because they wanted to borrow the same prestige of being on the same label as the Beatles. And so Decca was in a tough position. They had been sort of, they were, you know, left in the lurch. And when they came across the Rolling Stones, they were very desperate to find, you know, a new band that could be considered an answer to the Beatles. And so they gave ironically, the Stones got a much better recording contract initially than the Beatles did.
Okay, so how do you think that they influenced one another musically?
Well, that's a tough question. For a long time in the 60s, I think that the Stones did look to the Beatles as having established a bit of a template. So there are, you know, a few examples of times when the Beatles would go off in a particular creative direction and it would seem like the Stones were following or copying or imitating what the Beatles were doing. Although by the end of the 1960s, I think the Stones really began to focus more in their strongest medium of blues-inflected rock. And, you know, I don't write a lot about aesthetics in the book. I'm more interested in how the rivalry was constructed, you know, by fans and by people in the media and by the groups. But having said that, I do think that the Stones began to do some of their best work after they got over trying to, you know, imitate what the Beatles were doing.
Which is actually something, and we have some sound here, something that I think John Lennon was sensitive to and had felt for some time that the Stones were trying to influence them.
I resent the implication that the Stones are like revolutionaries and that the Beatles weren't, you know. If the Stones were or are, the Beatles really were. They're not in the same class, music-wise, or power-wise. Never were, and Mick always resented it. But I never said anything. I always admired them because I liked the funky music and I liked their style. I liked the direction they took after they got over trying to imitate us, you know.
Well, we went through some pretty strange times. We had a sort of a lot of rivalry in those early years and a little bit of friction, but we always ended up friends. And I like to think we still are. Because they were some of the greatest times of our lives, and I'm really proud to be the one that leads them into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame.
That was, first you heard John Lennon from a 1970 interview with Rolling Stone magazine, followed by Mick Jagger inducting the Beatles into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame in 1988. Two very different attitudes, although two very different situations in which they were speaking there. But it is interesting, I have to say, John Lennon does not come across as a nice guy in this book at all.
You know, a lot of people have said that. He's a complicated character, and, you know, he had a very, very tough upbringing, and so you can only feel sorry for him in some respects. He had the abandonment and loss that he dealt with as a young man probably shaped his character in some ways that caused him to be a difficult person, and he could be mean and a tough guy to get along with. It's true. That interview that you played was from 1970, was when he was in a particularly dark place. The Beatles were breaking up. He was using a lot of heroin, which isn't good for anyone's mood. That was a very famously cranky interview that you played, but it does get to the fact that he sometimes felt the Beatles, or the Stones rather, were riding the Beatles' coattails.
I mean, did the two bands have anything to lose ultimately by expressing admiration for one another?
Well, they often expressed admiration for one another. So that's the thing that a lot of people don't understand. They were both friends and rivals. I think that they truly admired what the other group was doing. And they enjoyed each other's company, especially after they both became so world famous. A lot of people they couldn't relate to a lot of people who didn't have similar experiences, and they couldn't trust a lot of people who wanted to befriend them, and so they would socialize in these rarefied circles, and they enjoyed each other's company, and I think they wished the best for each other, except they wanted to outperform each other as well, if that makes sense. I think it's very easy to imagine, you know, being friendly with someone, but also if you're in a competitive industry, or you're still wanting to outperform them.
Well, and that competition, I suppose, drove both bands as long as they both existed.
Sure, and it wasn't just the Beatles and the Stones. I mean, they're the most tantalizing groups to compare. But, you know, don't forget the Beach Boys and the Kinks and the Who and all these other groups were out there at the same time. And everyone was paying close attention to what the others were doing. And I think that just the creative ferment of that era is, you know, almost unprecedented in popular music. And it made every group want to, you know, do their very best and step up their game.
Can you talk about this? You know, the Beatles broke up, as you mentioned, in 1970. There was a great demand for what they were doing. Meanwhile, the Rolling Stones are still, you know, they still tour occasionally. Did that affect Do you think the way that they were held dear by fans, by music critics, by people sort of looking at their body of work?
I think so. I think the Beatles in some odd way, you know, really enhanced their legacy by virtue of the fact that when they broke up in 1970, they were still very much near the top of their power. And they never got back together again. They never shared a stage again or recorded a new record or anything else. And so, and in a sense, you know, the Beatles never really grew old as a group. And the Rolling Stones took a different route. They did some great work in the late 60s and early 70s. I think that they had a stretch from about 68 to 72, and they put out some of the finest rock records that we've ever had. But then they went on to, I would argue, dilute their catalog with some mediocre records.
Some disco.
They tallied with disco and they put out a lot of material that I think was just subpar. And then they reinvented themselves and for the last 20-odd years or 30-odd years as sort of a nostalgia act where they're not really pushing new material. They're just playing the same old hits from 30 and 40 years ago. And they play those songs, you know, to sound exactly like they did on the record. They don't even experiment with new arrangements. They're appealing mostly to baby boomer fans who can afford their very expensive tickets, and they're not really, you know, pushing new material or innovating the way, you know, maybe some people wish they would.
Do you think they're unable to innovate anymore, or is it simply that they've recognized that nobody wants to hear their new music?
Well, I can only speculate, but, you know, Mick Jagger is really running he runs the Rolling Stones a lot like a person would a corporation nowadays. And what they're doing with their ticket prices, I find slightly appalling. On their last tour, it would take a few minutes to explain, but they've pioneered this thing called a flex pricing ticket strategy, which means that they try to get the most amount for their tickets that the market will bear for any particular show. And that means that the average seats are over $400. Sometimes they're $1,000, and the only people who can afford to see shows at that rate are adults, teenagers, and young people can't do it. So I guess they're giving baby boomers what they want to hear. Is my guess.
John McMillan is my guest. He's assistant professor of history at Georgia State University and author of the new book, Beatles vs. Stones. Join us at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education. Classes are available in everything from fine arts to financial planning, and gift certificates are available at 214-768-CAPE or smu.edu/think.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with Georgia State University Assistant Professor John McMillan, author of the new book, Beatles vs. Stones. You can join us at 1-800-933-5372. Send a tweet to me at Chris Boyd Think, or you can go and send an email to think@kera.org. Let's go to the phones now and speak with Janet in Dallas. Hi, Janet.
Hi, I'm really enjoying this show, having grown up during the 60s. But one thing I wanted to point out is, and I want to say this was in 1967, but I know it wasn't all that long after Sgt. Pepper came out, that the Stones put out an album that was, I look back, I think it was sort of an homage to Sgt. Pepper. And one thing about it was instead of, oh, this song and that song. I mean, it was like, you know, a totality, and it was different from what they usually did. I think that like some of the songs were She's a Rainbow, and I don't know if this is ringing a bell for anyone, but it really was something that everybody thought they were doing really to say to the Beatles, hey, we like what you're doing, and here's our version of it.
Well, thanks for your call, Janet. What can you tell us about that, John?
Well, she's right. You know, in the summer of 1967, the Beatles put out Sgt. Pepper, which I don't know if it's the best Beatles record, but it was released with more triumphal fanfare than any record in history. It was a huge success. And, of course, that was a quasi, you know, psychedelic-sounding record. And about 6 months later, the Stones came out with their Satanic Majesty's Request, which was their attempt to do a psychedelic record. And at the time, it was widely panned as ersatz Beatles. I know some people nowadays have given that, you know, the Satanic Majesty's Record a second look, and they think that it's actually better than people thought at the time. But it was widely panned, and the Stones, you know, and the cover, they were dressed in these wizard robes in this weird landscape set out of like Tolkien or something, and they looked kind of ridiculous, and they just weren't very convincing as hippies, and so they got a lot of grief for that record.
What have they said in the subsequent years about that album and what their thinking was?
It's hysterical. Keith Richards claims not to remember it. I wrote in the book he sounds a bit like a drunk after a bad night. He just says he doesn't remember recording those sessions, and I think they even the Stones would admit that it was a bit of a misstep. Although, the caller mentioned that song She's a Rainbow, which is a really lovely song, and that appears on that record.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Let's speak with Martin in Fort Worth. Hi, Martin.
Hello, Chris. Hello, John.
Hi.
You know, a little while ago, you were talking about the various bands were, you know, obviously competing, but they respected each other. And the one band I was hoping you would mention as far as their opinion of that band coming out of England that was so different than all of them and kind of underground, if you will, and that was Led Zeppelin, and I wondered what you could tell me what those people, the Stones and the Beatles, may have thought of that music.
Well, you've got me a little bit stumped. You know, Led Zeppelin comes along a little bit later. They would have known Jimmy Page, who was a guitarist who played in some of the same circles that the Beatles traveled in. But I just don't know that I've ever encountered any Beatles comments on Led Zeppelin, so I'm afraid I feel bad, but I don't really know the answer.
So how did each band fare under the management of Alan Klein?
Poorly. It's all very complicated. Alan Klein became the manager for the Rolling Stones, and he was he had a lot of buzz about him because he was thought to be, well, he was in fact a real accounting wizard, and he knew music industry law and accounting practices very well, and he was quite famous for, you know, going into the books of the record companies and finding money that they had not paid to some of their performers and so on. And he was this disciplined, you know, shark-eyed money man. And so he had a great reputation, but then he was also a thief. And the Stones found that out firsthand because he took the copyright from a lot of their songs in a sort of tricky way. And then later on, Alan Klein became the manager of the Beatles. John Lennon was very taken with Alan Klein. And Paul McCartney was not, so that was a big dispute. But John was able to persuade George and Ringo to sort of take his position. And long story short, he was a thief. So he had a negative influence on both groups, and he contributed to the Beatles' demise in some respects, I think, because there was a lot of controversy about whether they should be going with him or not.
We have an email here from Mike who says, how important were BBC radio and TV performances to each group as they became more mature as musicians in the late 60s?
Well, here again, I'm not sure if I have a great answer to that question. You know, there were so many BBC recordings that the Beatles did, and a lot of them are just coming out now as official releases, but then there's a huge trove of BBC material that is unreleased, and these are, you know, demos and alternate recordings of various songs. And so Beatles obsessives are really clamoring to get their hands on that material. I don't know what else to say about that. Both groups continued to, you know, perform on television, and they put together televised specials. But I don't know what else to say.
What kind of ongoing social contact did they have over the years before and after the Beatles breakup?
Well, they seem to hang out the most in two separate periods. In about 1963, the Beatles, as I mentioned before, were becoming big enough in England that they felt they had to move from Liverpool to London. And when they got there, they didn't really understand the club scene or know a lot about the place. And they befriended the Stones, and I think the Stones very generously showed the Beatles around a little bit and took them to some clubs. And They enjoyed hanging out then. And then there was another period after the Beatles finally quit recording. So in, you know, 67, during the swinging London era, they were spending a lot more time in London, and the Beatles and the Stones again would socialize in these forbidding clubs and nightlife spots where pop royalty would mingle together.
We have an email here from Mary who writes, I grew up in the UK in the 60s and parents were not accepting of the Beatles. They were considered often to be long-haired hooligans in the initial years. We followed them in monthly magazines and on Top of the Pops.
Well, I don't think that's correct. You know, in the UK, I mentioned before, they won an award from Harold Wilson, who would later become the Prime Minister. They got very favorable coverage in newspapers. They played in front of the British royal family. So I don't doubt that some parents disapproved of the Beatles. But in England, they were regarded as a national treasure. Now, in the United States, however, I think it was a bit different. I've talked to a lot of people who were baby boomers who told me that their parents were a bit alarmed by the Beatles. And a lot of the coverage of the Beatles when they came over here to the States was focused not so much on their music, but on the kind of hysterical reactions they were eliciting from teenage girls. And that was a source of consternation for some parents as well.
Did the rivalry, I mean, so it, clearly it helped to sell magazines and helped to keep people paying attention to both bands. Was it something that you think fans themselves enjoyed engaging in?
I think to some degree. You know, as you know, the Beatles were seen as the group that almost everyone liked, and so they had the kind of imprimatur of adults and the establishment and so on. And so there's always going to be a group of young people who feel that they're more culturally discerning and that they were more rebellious and disaffected, and so it was very important to them to place themselves in the Stones camp. And sometimes, you know, fans would dress differently depending on which group they liked, and fans would get, you know, very intransigent. You know, they would very much support one group over the other. And nowadays we can look at it and see it as a bit silly, because I think that the smart thing would have been to really admire both groups. But certainly people felt that, a lot of people felt you had to have an allegiance. You could be a Beatles fan or a Stones fan, and you really had to declare a preference.
How did, you know, radio stations and things like that handle this rivalry?
Good question. I don't know. I'm sure they talked, in England, I'm sure they talked about it a great deal. Mm-hmm. It was something, again, I mentioned that they had these different media environments in England, so there was a lot of press attention to the rivalry. And if the Rolling Stones, for instance, outperformed the Beatles in a particular poll that some music magazine had, you would hear all about it. It would be a big topic of conversation.
Well, I guess my point was they were being played by the same stations, regardless of what people thought about liking one over the other.
Oh, sure, that's mm-hmm. true. Yeah, I don't think there were Beatles and Stones stations. These were both groups that appealed to young people.
Were the Stones relieved by the breakup of the Beatles?
That's a good question, and it's tough to say. You know, on the one hand, the Stones really admired the Beatles' work, and I think they might have been like everyone else, a little sad to see him break up. And I've read some quotes from Keith Richards suggesting also that he wished that the Beatles had not been so tawdry about going to the press and breaking up in such an unpleasant way and making such a big media story about it. But also the Stones may have been disappointed because I think, as I said before, they were doing a lot of their very best work in the late 60s and early 70s, right when the Beatles were disintegrating, so that two bands were never competing, you know, head-to-head when they were both at their very best. This is maybe my own preference, but that's how I see it.
Yeah, that's interesting. So it wasn't necessarily that the Beatles had to go away for the Stones to come into their own.
No, but when the Beatles did go away, the Stones did do some, I think, those records in the late 60s and early 70s were their very best, and they weren't using the Beatles as any kind of a template or trying to glom onto what the Beatles were doing. I think they were coming into their own by that point as musicians and songwriters.
To what extent do you think that each group, and maybe the rivalry that was concocted between them, helped to set the mold for what rock stars were supposed to be, were supposed to look like, were supposed to represent?
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, certainly since the, you know, since the Rolling Stones, it's become pretty, I think it's a scam that a lot of rock stars get into where they act outrageously and cause a lot of controversy and try to provoke consternation from parents. And then, of course, that always inevitably enhances their popularity with young people. And the Stones really pioneered that. And I think, you know, the Stones are so widely accepted today that I think a lot of young people don't quite realize just how dangerous they seemed in the 60s. The authorities really had it out for the Stones, and they were objects of tabloid fury, and they had problems with the law. And there was a lot of consternation about the fact that the Stones were just a bad influence for young people. And since the Stones, a lot of other groups have been doing the same thing. You see it in rap music. You see it in bands from my childhood, like Guns N' Roses, were doing, you know, more or less the same sort of thing.
Yeah, it's almost like they have to prove they're cool by getting in trouble.
Uh-huh.
Mm-hmm. Do you think they were ultimately comfortable with the images that were created for them? Because it seems that, you know, the Beatles in particular sort of shifted out of that clean-cut image that was initially created for them.
Yeah, I think the Beatles were relieved by a certain point. You know, they certainly weren't happy or relieved when their manager died. But that gave them a little bit more freedom to go in the direction they wanted to go into. And they became, you know, confident enough and settled enough in their success that they no longer felt they had to scrupulously adhere to this, you know, pleasing image. They could show a bit more of their own personality. And so I think the Beatles enjoyed doing that. You know, to some degree, I think the Stones might have gotten carried away with this bad boy image, which maybe didn't always suit their personalities. Poor drummer Charlie Watts for the Rolling Stones never really fit in with any of this because he was happily married to his wife for most of his life, and he wanted nothing to do with the drugs and the groupies for a very long time. And then people like Keith Richards, of course, had, you know, terrible experiences with drugs and with the law, I think because he may have gotten a little carried away with this outlaw persona.
Did you listen exclusively to Beatles and Stones music while writing the book, or do you have to sort of stay away from that while you're composing text?
I always listen to the Beatles and the Stones from time to time. I mean, by this point, I'm so familiar with all of their work that I play it along with all sorts of other things. But listening to the music didn't really seem to affect my writing or thinking process so much with the book. I'm a huge fan of both groups, obviously.
And so are you not going to share which one is your very favorite?
You know, I'm afraid not. People ask me all the time. And I don't mean to be impolite, but as I've been trying to say, it's a joint biography. And I'm a historian. I'm not really a rock critic, and I'm not even a musician. So I don't really have the vocabulary for writing about music and with the sophistication that a lot of other people do. It's really not my skill set. I think I'm better at juxtaposing the groups and bringing some surprising material to light. And then finally, also, I just did not want to alienate half my audience, because you would not believe in these online fora how acrimonious debates can be between Beatles fans and Stones fans. The one thing I'm pleased about is that I do have a preference for one group over the other, but I decided not to declare it.
I'm going to have to jump in here because we're out of time, but you don't tell us in the book, and it's tough to figure out. The new book is called
That's What I'm Pleased About,
the Beatles vs. Stones by John McMillan. John, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you very much. I had a nice time. Thank you.
Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening, and have a great day.